Okay, so it's my pleasure and privilege to be moderating a final session, which is called The Road Ahead, Building a Movement for Inclusive Asylum. So first of all, I'd like to start off by thanking the organisers, Oxford City of Sanctuary, British Red Cross, Refugee Studies Centre and the City of Sanctuary National Group for organising the event. And in particular, the host of volunteers who've worked tirelessly throughout the last 2 days and being strikingly efficient and also really welcoming. So that kind of embodies what we've been talking about over the 2 days as well. So thank you so much for that. For me, the conference for the last couple of days has been commendable for its energy, its innovation and also its courage. In terms of energy, the different examples that we've had from different national, international contexts that have been discussed so passionately has been very inspiring for me. The opportunity to share ideas and share successes and offer comments on other ideas has been fantastic. And not just formally in the sessions that we've shared together, but also in the informal spaces between the sessions and the breaks as well. It's been wonderful to talk with so many passionate and engaged people. In terms of innovation, what I've enjoyed personally the most is the mix of speakers, and it's something that I know the organisers thought very clearly and very hard about, in terms of getting a mix between advocacy groups, people with first-hand experience of the system, activists and academics as well. And it's one of the first principles of the City of Sanctuary movement that those who've experienced the system firsthand should be central to the heart of the work of advocacy that it undertakes. And then thirdly, in terms of courage, what we've seen over the last couple of days is that we've been taking on some pretty tough questions. We've been talking about different ways of campaigning, different ways of countering social exclusion, and different ways to promote safe routes as well. And I think that the conference has offered a very productive space in that regard, a space of discussion, and we need this at this moment in time. A space for dialogue, honest deliberation, and supportive critique of each other's efforts. So I think it's been really timely. So congratulations again to the audience. So in terms of wrapping up the event, which is going to be interesting and challenging in its own right, but pulling together the various threads that we've heard about through the last couple of days, we've got a series of speakers. I'll introduce them individually as they come up and speak. So first of all, Richard Stanton. He's the co-founder and chair of Migration Work CIC, a not-for-profit consultancy working in the UK and across Europe on responses to migration that help communities and places to move towards integration. So I've asked the speakers to speak for 10 minutes each, and then we will have a time for just some final announcements and also some discussion right at the end. Thanks.
Thanks, Nick, and thanks again to the organisers for this very valuable conference and the opportunity to say a few words. Finally, I'm, as Nick says, founder of Migration Work, not Migration Watch, which I gather I was mixed up with at one point in the other. And just so you understand the context of what I'm saying, I also in my time have been quite involved in local politics in the city where I live, down on the south coast, and also I was for 8 years led work for the Mayor of London on immigration and asylum. And so some of that experience also informs what I'm going to say, which is perhaps a bit different in a sense, although I have a very strong sense of recapping, in reflecting a lot of what's been said already, but I'm focusing on really the politics of this country, England, as I would phrase it, Northern Britain, the politics of England. But in doing that, I hope we very much don't lose sight of the international links, which have been such a really valuable part of this conference. The road ahead. First, let's think about the terrain across which we build the road. I want to make 4 points about that terrain. Firstly, democracy is the route. We have to win over time, and the point was made in the previous session, we have to win over time majority support for the right of people to move, the right of people to find safety. It's a big, big challenge, but that's the route. Second point, we have a long way to travel. Third point, how then do we change opinions? And I would argue it's by what in some discussions we call agency. by people having the chance to act for themselves. And now I'm talking about people in the host community, as well as the refugees and migrants, and all of us in the sector. Democracy is the route. It's a long way to go. The way to go is to enable people to have a role as actors, to find agency, to become agents in their world. And last point in mapping the ground we have to cover is we are not alone. And I'll explain what I mean by that. And then I'll say a few words about, now we've got the idea of the ground we've got to cover, how do we make that road? How do we build that road ahead? So as I say, we have somehow to win the argument not only amongst those who are close to us, and that's an expanding group, but more widely. A long way to go. I'll refer here to some research that my organisation, Migration Work, was commissioned to do during the winter, asking the question, given the strength of the refugee welcome movement that had built up during the summer and the autumn, certainly not starting then, but really, really amazingly developed, what could we do to take that further and to make it into a wider movement for rights for refugees and indeed other migrants, perhaps? And we found, and it wasn't a huge study, but we found very clearly a number of points that were hugely encouraging. Vast range of groups involved, and this was said earlier, we guess in the thousands had emerged. And the really interesting thing is, most of them were very local, a lot of them were beneath the radar, simply not part of what we thought of as the sector. They were drawing in new people who hadn't been involved in work on refugee and migrant rights before. And what came out of it was a lot of the people, the newer people coming in, were hungry, really hungry to find out more. They came in often on the most basic humanitarian instinct, and they really wanted to take a wider view. Just a quick comment from people working within a group in a northern, actually in Leeds, okay, I'll say in Leeds, commenting, hope it wasn't somebody who's here. I have permission to quote this bit at least. We don't have to politicise our volunteers in this part of this group campaigning on refugee welcome and support. Every single one becomes radicalised by the process of meeting them, refugees. Most people find out it's substantially worse than they first thought. What we offer is a personal connection to a global issue. We try and get people to do their activism themselves. There is awakening of social and political consciences through this process. I think that is incredibly powerful. And it's a tribute to work which many of you have been involved in. It goes beyond simply people wanting to help. They begin to want to engage in a wider process. So that's very positive. That's taking us forward. But we must not get carried away. There is a long distance still to travel. A piece of work, for instance, by Ipsos Mori, I believe not published yet, quoted by in a recent report for Migration Policy Institute about the anxious middle, putting forward the view that there's a chunk of people in the middle of opinion in Britain which is not committed either way and is open to argument. Yeah, but what this Ipsos Mori research found was, 70% of people sign up to the view that Britain should be committed to protection of refugees. Great, 70%. But we're familiar with the statement from government, the standard thing, practically every document on immigration asylum policy I've seen in the last 15 to 20 years has said the proud tradition of Britain of welcoming refugees. There is a level at which people will sign up to that. But the sad reality is, at this point, it was just after Cameron had agreed to the 20,000 Syrians being resettled, only 25% of people wanted him to go further, and 30% of people, roughly, said there should be no more refugees admitted at all. So, I mean, this is the situation we're familiar with. My point is, something incredibly powerful is happening, but we've a long way to go. A few words about how opinions change. I think we need to reflect on this on both sides of the great conflict we're involved in, political debate we're involved in. And let me emphasise here, I'm not underestimating the importance of things we've discussed here, and which I've personally been involved in for at least 15, maybe 20 years, which is the importance of communications, of messaging, the role of the media, and as part of that, a crucial part of that, the voices of refugees and migrants themselves. All of that is vital. I would argue it's not enough. We're actually doing something beyond that, which is far more powerful than we sometimes realise, which is involving people in activity, and it's different. Communications, in the usual sense, messaging, is about somebody sending a message into my head. Getting involved in action is, I'm doing something, for maybe a very, very simple, basic reason. I'm getting involved, and I have to think, why am I doing this? How does this relate to my values, to my feelings about my family, about my city, about my country, about the world I live in? I have to start thinking it through for myself, and that becomes a far more powerful form of learning. And it works the other way as well. If we ask what drives xenophobia, I've come round to the view, after many years of distress at the state of opinion amongst my fellow citizens, is that xenophobia, the concern, this anxiety, the hostility about foreigners, has become so extraordinarily great in this country because in this country our political culture is so weak. People, and it's no accident, it's mainly older people and working class people in particular, people have been left out of processes of change that have transformed their world, mostly in ways that are for the worse. People have lost the workplaces they're familiar, the patterns of work they're familiar with, the public space which they used to own that is now privatised, the opportunities for housing they used to have, the family structures they used to have. People's worlds have been transformed by what Don Flynn was talking about, the globalisation, the destruction of old forms, old relationships by globalisation. And if we ask why are people determined to blame somebody else, the reason is, and I've heard this said myself on the doorstep, no one cares what I think. The so-called hostility to immigration, to my mind, is actually deep down not about immigration. It's about people saying, the world has changed. I was given no say in this. I want somebody to blame. And conversely, for us, an openness to tolerance, the ability to welcome newcomers, really takes off when people can begin to act and to put that into practice. That's when it really becomes embedded, becomes a part of who they are. And as I say, we've seen in the refugee welcome movement, new people are coming in, and that process is beginning. I do agree, we're at the beginnings of some of a really positive process, but we have to make that happen more extensively. I pick up something that Adironga said just in session just now, something really important that absolutely encapsulated what I feel about this. We must not let the situation define us, we define the situation. And that, both for us in our sector and for people beyond. The last point I was going to make about mapping the ground is we are not alone. The need for protection, and I refer that very much to what Don Flynn said, and I hope you won't mind me plagiarising. The point about the search, people's search for protection, about people's search for a better life, crossing borders to seek a better life, is that this is no crisis. This is no emergency. This is part of the world we live in, which is a world of expropriation, of exploitation, of gross and rising inequality, and the violence that comes out of that kind of world. Earlier this year, Oxfam did a survey of wealth across the world. You're familiar with the 1% of the world's population having more wealth than the other 99%. The thing that really shocked me was, in the Oxfam survey, was the bottom half of the world's population in terms of wealth, the poorest half of the world's population, 3.5 million people, have suffered a fall in their wealth of 41%, two-fifths of the value of their wealth lost between 2010 and 2015. This is a world not only of hugely concentrating wealth, but also rising poverty. And that affects people in the north as well. Mariana there was reminding us about, she said, white people also on the streets. White people also committing suicide because their welfare benefits are being withdrawn, because they're told they're not disabled even though they can't actually work. Crushing, distressing change also in the global north. And last point, on the reason why we're not alone. Over generations, refugees and asylum seekers have helped to drive the movement for justice also in so-called destination countries, the countries they come to. Refugees and asylum seekers are part of the world we live in. They're going to remain part of the world we live in, and their role is crucial in both in showing where the stresses and the contradictions and the violence is, but also in helping us to address it within our own system as well here in this country. So mapping the road in a few words, I very much agree with the point about coordination. There was a very useful contribution from a colleague who works in social media. Let's not reinvent the wheel, let's duplicate. But in the work we did, we came to the conclusion there does need to be a national framework. It should be non-directive, it should respect local difference, but bring, I think, to have an annual gathering of 3 or 4 days is well worth fundraising for myself. And it should work across categories, it should have a rights focus, focus on creating places of welcome, and it should involve the voices of refugees and migrants, both as part of, as we know, part of conveying the experience of their experience to host population, but also to monitor and evaluate what we are doing, so that we know each year, are we making a difference? And through this process, last point, through this process, I would like to emphasise, we must connect the struggles. I was meeting last week about the EU referendum, and we were talking quite a lot about migration. A man stood, I live in Brighton, he with a large gay population, and he was saying, hate crimes against LGBT people in Brighton have gone up by a third in the last year. A city of sanctuary should be a place where LGBT people feel safe. A city of sanctuary should be a place where homelessness is disappearing. A city of sanctuary should be a place where public health services are going to remain available to everyone in the public. A city of sanctuary should be a place that fights racism in general. And in creating that kind of broad movement, I think we'll have a social movement for inclusive asylum, because asylum is part of the world we live in, and we're all suffering from that world. We all need to create a better world.
Thank you, Richard. Now I'd like to introduce Professor Alexander Betts. He's Professor of Forced Migration and International Affairs, the Director of the Refugee Studies Centre. His research focuses on the politics and economics of refugees. In addition to many academic publications, he's written for various newspapers and appeared regularly on BBC, Al Jazeera and CNN. He's served as consultant to a range of international organisations and was honoured this year as a young global leader by the World Economic Forum. Alexander Betts.
Thank you. I think the members of this panel might end up vigorously agreeing with one another. It's been a real privilege for us as the Refugee Studies Centre to host this conference and to be able to work with City of Sanctuary and the British Red Cross. It was a little bit of an experiment for us, just to say that last year we did something that on a very small scale engaged with Refugee Week, and we had a panel session, and we wanted to do something a bit bolder and slightly more ambitious and broaden beyond the community, nationally and transnationally across Europe. And we wanted to do something that could have practical impact. And I think, for me, just listening to so many of the discussions, it surpassed all my expectations. There's been a huge amount of dynamism, a real appetite to learn from one another, to think practically about how we can make a difference and bring real change. And I think that energy suggests there's something here, amongst everybody here collectively, to take this forwards and do something. And so really what I want to just focus some very brief remarks on is where we go from here. I said in my opening remarks that I really hoped that you would get to the end of the 2 days having a sense of what the different ideas you've learned would be, who the new people you've met that you would continue to stay in touch with would be. But I also think it's important to ask, what are the things you're going to do practically in the real world as a result of the conversations you've had here and the ideas you've engaged with? And my challenge to all of you is to think of at least one thing you are going to do differently as a result of what you've experienced here. The purpose of this conference was to build up a social movement for inclusive asylum. or to build upon the work that's already going on as part of that social movement. And I just want to reflect upon what we can do next in terms of building that social movement in three parts. Why do we need that social movement? What does that social movement need to achieve? And how, practically, do we build that social movement? And to do that, I want to draw upon what I've heard over the 2 days and play back to you, with a slightly biased spin, some of the ideas that I've listened to. The why we need this should be fairly obvious to all of us. But I think it comes both from the negative case of all the terrible things that we see in Britain and Europe, the shocking abdication of responsibility by our political elites, but also the positive side, the really positive, inspiring stories we've heard of social enterprise, community engagement, refugee and migrant-led initiative and community-based organisations. There's so much that we can build upon. We've heard firsthand the intolerable levels of social exclusion that don't even meet the minimum standards of human dignity, let alone contribute to what we should expect everybody to enjoy in terms of human flourishing. We've been on a tour across Europe, from Italy to Bulgaria to Calais and back to the UK, and we've seen the deprivation of things we would regard to be fundamental rights. And as Gemma Gilley said, one of the things that should shock us is that we are not sufficiently shocked. That the levels of outrage that we should be experiencing and disseminating, we've become inured to over time. So I think we need to take that, package it strategically, and disseminate it to a wider public to make sure that the public are engaged. But we've also heard that there are ways in which small pockets of initiative by concerned citizens make an extraordinary difference. That, as Brindish said in the opening panel, it was just a naive dream to do something different that led her to privately offer 5 additional places for refugees in Iceland, leading to transformation in the country. So no individual is too small to not make a difference. We all have our part to play. But we also need to do things that are practical for people to engage with. We need to find tipping points in civil society where people come on board and engage. And the messaging has to be clear, it has to be well motivated, but it also has to be strategic. And I think the real insight from this is that we are stronger collectively. We need to work not just in our own silos, not for the interests of our own organisation, understandably concerned sometimes with funding and territory, but recognise that we are stronger. As Al-Mami said, unity is where the power comes from. We can't act in isolation. We have to find ways to act collectively. And so what can we do collectively? What are the goals we need to strive for? I think there are 4 things that stand out for me from the conversation. The first that has to be at the heart of this is to empower refugees and migrants themselves. We heard from Anila Noor the idea that there should be nothing about us without us. And I think that idea is extremely powerful. But too often we have elite conversations, and I regret that this is a panel of all white British men. And we need to do far more to ensure that we empower the people with the experiences and the real expertise to have a voice. One of the ideas that I've been playing around with the Undersecretary General of the IFRC, Jamila Mahmood, to counterbalance the elite summits we see, the World Humanitarian Summit, and the 19th of September UN General Assembly Summit on Refugees and Migrants that have excluded refugee and migrant voices, is imagine a global refugee conference led by refugees where they decide who they invite. And if it's hosted on a territory and they exclude refugees from accessing the territory, we name and shame them for their visa policies. There are other ways in which we can think about that model at a local level. Yes, many of us who sit in ivory towers like Oxford University have training in how to speak to public audiences, and not everyone has that. But it doesn't take much to empower people to be able to articulate for themselves the message that they want to take. Why can't we run public speaking workshops? Why can't we connect people to our networks in the media? Why can't we empower people to tell their own stories? One of the parts of the work at the Refugee Studies Centre that I'm most proud of is the way in which, through our research, we try to engage communities in our work. In Uganda, for instance, we've embarked on research that is on the economic lives of refugees. And through that, we've trained refugees to be peer researchers. Around 40 refugees from Somalia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, South Sudan, Rwanda. And they contributed massively to the research, but they were also able to disseminate that book and speak on its behalf, changing the framing of refugees from inevitable burdens to contributors to their host societies. We were reminded by Almami in one of his questions that one of the great things about this society is it is a democratic society in which, in theory, we protect freedom of speech. What a waste of that freedom of speech if we don't empower people to have an impact. The second practical thing I think we need to think about is how we engage the wider public, that middle part of British society, how we take the message to them, how we ensure that at the local level and the national level, politicians have the right messages to feel able and empowered to speak on behalf of migrant and refugee rights. We can't exclude that group of people and just speak within an echo chamber amongst ourselves. We have to take the public with us. And this brings me to the third thing I think we need to strive for, which is to not give up on taking political elites with us. As Gonzalo Vargas Llosa of UNHCR reminded us, UNHCR and those elites can't necessarily do everything by themselves, but perhaps neither can civil society. The strength is in that MINSA movement of forming strategic alliances with those in positions of power, politicians that want to help, international organisations that want to help, but need a movement from civil society. So I think rather than neglecting those groups, thinking strategically about how we can connect top-down and bottom-up is likely to be strategically impactful. The fourth thing that I think has come out strongly is the idea of framing, the narrative, how we build shared language. Over the last year, I think we've organically moved towards a position of that counter-narrative. But while the narrative that is anti-immigration has a powerful marketing vehicle, a powerful public relations vehicle, civil society is often fragmented and has different language, different messages, and I think we need to be more thoughtful about how we build, as Don Flynn said, that collective shared narrative, use common language, and disseminate it. And just a word on the role that I think academia can play on that. I don't think it's good enough for academics to stay in their ivory towers. I think the advantage of a university space is it has a convening power like this to bring people together. It also has a position where it can collect evidence-based data. It can provide part of the narrative. It can inform advocacy. But we need partners to do that. We need places where we can place our research, place the messages, so they can be disseminated to the right people and have an impact. But I think it's right to say, as Don Flynn articulated, that the public does not understand what's happening. And that's because our leaders are not articulating who's coming from where and why to the public. They're not explaining why, inevitably, the factors of mobility and fragility in a globalising world need more and more people to cross borders. So how can we take these strategic ideas and build them collectively? And this is what we should be focusing on in this session, the practical next steps. I think we have to be, of course, realistic. As we heard in the previous session, all too often, many groups have grand ambitions, and coming away with the sort of excitement of a conference and proposing that we build something enormous may be unrealistic. But I think there are things that can be done collectively. So the ideas I would put forward, and I'd seek for feedback on, are, one, could we envisage doing a regular conference like this? The value that comes from learning and building networks at a conference like this is quite unique. If so, where and how could we get commitments to build that? Could it be an annual Sanctuary Europe conference? Could others build sub-conferences in different country levels here across Europe at the local level? Who could take the initiative on that? Would it be City of Sanctuary? Who'd be willing to play a part in something like that? How can we build a network that is a form of loose coordination and information sharing? Is it as simple as an email list? Is it an online platform? Does it work with existing platforms and existing blogs that we already see rather than duplicate them? Which ones could they and should they be? And how can we embed that initiative of a network in local practice, making the best of local faith-based communities, local political entities, the network of the Red Cross, and others? I think there's a question we've got to ask about how we build on the transnational elements of this. This has been unique in involving not just British civil society, but civil society across Europe. And I think that's one of the strengths, to think across geographical levels of local, national, regional, and global, and begin to build those networks. Finally, a very practical idea that's been put forward by a group of the organisers and other people at the conference is that immediately out of this event, we could put together a shared statement or a shared letter, that we could have as an open letter in a newspaper, The Guardian, The Independent, as an open letter that we could all share with our politicians, with some basic principles, some basic messages that are key to what we've heard. Things like, and I'm just suggesting, the basic message that needs to come through, which is that migrants and asylum seekers and refugees are first and foremost human beings with human rights. And irrespective of their immigration status, we need to provide forms of exclusion and respect for those rights. Messages like the encouragement to politicians to have an open and honest narrative to explain to their publics why, in the context of globalisation, migration is normal. Messages of tolerance and fighting against xenophobia and hate speech that have become so important and have a real and immediate recognition in the context of events over the last couple of weeks. And really practical guidance that can say social exclusion is intolerable irrespective of migrant status. That the practice of destitution and detention that we've discussed so often here cannot be tolerated in a liberal democratic society. So I think what I would like to suggest is in the discussion we focus on what those practical next steps should be and how we begin to take the message here to a wider audience. My only regret from this conference is that we've had a capacity of around 80 when so many of these messages need to reach a much wider public.
Thank you. And the final speaker is Jonathan Ellis. Jonathan is a campaigner who's had various successful campaigns over the last 15 years. He's now head of policy, research and advocacy at the British Red Cross, as well as voluntary roles as chairman of the Bishop Simeon Trust and vice chair of City of Sanctuary.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. I'm conscious you're the last speaker, so I promise I will endeavour to be brief, but great to have a chance to have a few words. Firstly, just to thank the organisers for what has been, I think we can agree, a remarkable event, bringing the national and the international together. And I stand before you as a representative of the British Red Cross, large, established humanitarian agency, 150 years of humanitarian action. We are proud that we work in 60 locations across the UK providing humanitarian support to refugees. And I'm also proud to stand here as a representative of City of Sanctuary, only 10 years old. Now 70 towns and cities of sanctuary, local people coming together, providing a welcome to asylum seekers and refugees. And what we saw, we thought last year, was what we call a revolution of generosity. Something quite distinctive happened last year, and we need to make sure we never go back and we keep building on that. And in essence, I want three key things that I'll take away and I'd like to share with you in these final comments. The first point, and it's in the title of our event, Building a Social Movement, is the importance of building a movement, by which I mean a movement and not just an organisation. A movement will encompass many different organisations, style of organisations. It'll have space for individuals. It strikes me in the UK that we have a history of movement building. If you think about the anti-slavery movement, it wasn't one organisation, it was a movement of organisations and individuals. And despite the fact that we have these rigid NGOs and charities, we need to discover that sense of movement building, genuinely building a movement. And I had the privilege recently to be involved in the New Beginnings Fund, collection of funders coming together to support refugee support. And what was remarkable about that fund and the applications for that fund was the number of new organisations set up. And I take the point that we don't need another ego forming another organisation, but what I love to see across the country was setting up groups that had never had groups before, welcoming asylum. I spoke at an event recently in Malvern, in Worcestershire. Malvern wanting to accept refugees. Over 100 people volunteering in Malvern, in Worcestershire. Utterly remarkable. Utterly remarkable, I think. But the tragedy is very often those groups are not connected. It's great to have this flurry of activity, but we need to connect, and that's where the essence of a movement comes in. And I think in recent months we've seen the manifestation of movement building. I think the campaign for Syrian resettlement, led by Refugee Council and Amnesty, yes, but a groundswell of popular support to our politicians saying, yes, we want to see Syrian refugees airlifted. I commend Detention Forum, the campaign against indefinite detention. What we've seen there is we've seen grassroots supports building, saying indefinite detention, not in our name. And I think when you look at movement building, there has to be respect between the national and the local. Change doesn't just happen at a national level or a local level. We need to respect both. I think this conference has brought the national and the local. We need to respect traditional advocacy done by organisations like the Red Cross and more grassroots organising. Both are really valuable. Let's respect the whole array of different ways that change happens. But try and have this umbrella, this wider movement, I think is really, really important. And that challenge we heard yesterday from UNHCR, and I think Gonzalo spoke so passionately about the issue around Eritrea and the private lobbying that he'd done on the country guidance. You know, as our movement grows, I think that is outrageous. Mike Kay spoke very passionately about the impact of the Eritrean country guidance. As a movement, it shouldn't just be UNHCR privately lobbying or the Red Cross trying to do something on the quiet. There should be a genuine sense of outrage of what this is happening, again, being done in our name. So I think Gonzalo challenged us if another Eritrea happened again. And I hope that we have the contacts and networks to actually encourage people to be mobilised to make sure that our voice is heard. So movement building is really important. The second point I want to make is around the importance of fresh thinking. I was really stimulated yesterday by the international examples, new ways of thinking, humanitarian visas. I love that freshness. This mantra of safe and legal routes sounds great. What does it even mean? What does it even mean? I think we really need some fresh thinking. And this, I think, is where the alliance with academia, I think, is so important. And I commend the organisers of this conference. The fresh thinking is great that it's happening across the universities in the UK, but the universities and NGOs, this movement, let's get these fresh ideas, because our conversations with government show us they haven't got those fresh ideas, and we need to be building on those. And my final point, and it came up yesterday and today, is that we're only really going to win this campaign and promote our movement and really win public support by contact theory. Humans having contact with humans. All of the evidence suggests that the most powerful response isn't at the national media level, but is at grassroots level. What I love about City of Sanctuary, it provides a platform, a forum, for British people to meet refugees. That's where we see real change. And within this movement, we're pushing for political change, but we're also getting humans to meet humans, and that is where we will see change happen. So I'll bring my comments to a close by saying just fantastic conference. I commend the organisers. I'm really proud to be part of City of Sanctuary, which is part of a movement. The key word, it's part of a movement. City of Sanctuary isn't the movement. What we have here is a number of us who are part of that movement. And I hope that you'll be inspired by this event. What this event has done is pulled together different sectors, different players, different people. This is a movement. This is the continuation of the building of a movement. We'll get changed by coming together with a real sense of injustice, of what's wrong, of what we don't want being done in our name. And if you take anything away, it's that sense of a movement. You are the catalyst for that movement. Let's continue building a movement in defence of asylum seekers and refugees. Thank you.
Okay, thanks to all our speakers, to Richard for helping us to think about coordination and challenges around that, Alex for inviting us to think about what the next practical steps are going to be, and Jonathan for his optimism and for reminding us to be outraged about some of the issues we've heard of the last couple of days. I would like to make one quick point before people start to leave, before we take questions, and that's just on staying in touch in a very practical way. So there were forms available when we came in, and the theory was that all of us were asked to sign a form to say that we can share our email addresses. If, however, for whatever reason, you didn't sign a form but you want to be kept on the email list, please make sure that you do sign that form before you leave. They'll be upstairs on the desk. Okay, it's just to make sure that we've got at least one way, and there are lots of others, of just staying in touch. Now, I'd like to throw open the floor to questions. Who would like to go? Oh, we'll take two or three at a time. So should we go right to the back first of all? Because that was the hand that I saw first, and then we'll come up to the middle and then to the left, yeah.
Thanks. My name is Antonia Wyatt, part of the movement for justice when it's necessary. I wanted to basically invite everyone here on the 10th of September, which is when we're planning to go back for another demonstration at Yardsville Detention Centre. And these demonstrations have really provoked a lot of people to understand more than they knew before. So I don't know for the organisations represented at the front if this is something, the kind of activism and grassroots that you're mentioning, but for building a movement to fight back and involve people inside and out of detention centres, this is an opportunity to do it. So I'll ask if the panels want to comment on if they see themselves banging fences and shouting outside detention centres, but also to invite everybody here to put that in their diary now and to be ready for the 10th of September. Thanks.
Lady in the middle, yeah, the row that you were at, Wayne. You did have your hand up before, I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Okay.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, sorry, I wanted to thank Alexandra, thank you, Alexandra, for everything you've done. I've seen your video clip yesterday, and that was so moving and amazing. The reason I'm saying this is because we sometimes look at the video they show about immigrants and refugees. It's always about, I'm not against them, but it's always about people from Syria and other places, but they never share about the African people who are suffering as well. So I was so impressed. I'm happy about what you put all your effort into. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
And we'll take one more question or comment, which is the lady... Oh, you're okay? Does anyone else want to add? I'll come to you next, but the lady next to you.
I just have a simple question. I would like to know if particularly maybe from Jonathan at the Red Cross, is there any movement or any effort to gather in people who are psychologists and psychiatrists as well? Because we focus a lot on physical things. But there's, I've discovered from quite a few people that there's a lot of mental health issues that need to be addressed, even sometimes mild ones, but and sometimes severe ones. That's my question.
Okay, thank you. So I don't have any particular order. Does anyone in the panel want to go first?
I'm happy to start with the question about, do I see myself banging on the doors outside detention centres? My very honest answer is no, personally, but I invite other people to do that. And one of the reasons for that is I think everybody in a movement has their comparative advantage where they can probably make a degree of difference. And as an academic in a university, I think I have a certain number of responsibilities to make the most of that position. And part of making the most of that position is to ensure that my message is as credible as it can be, with as many different audiences as possible. And if I get arrested at a detention centre, that's probably not going to do the message or the work any good. On the other hand, would I condemn that form of behaviour? Absolutely not, on the grounds that I think, in certain cases, radical public protest is an absolutely necessary means to challenge the government.
We're going to go to the other panel members and then I'll come back for a couple more questions.
To answer Antonio, similarly, in my organisation, we wouldn't get asked to do work and to contribute to, for example, trying to improve the policies of public authorities working with migrants and refugees in the UK and elsewhere, if we were thought to be an advocacy organisation. So we don't get directly involved as an organisation in advocacy. Individually, we get very much involved in demonstrations. Yardswood, I can't promise, but in principle, certainly. And one of my colleagues actually set up and runs an organisation called Music in Detention, which is about building links between people outside detention centres and inside through the medium of exchanging music and then develop music together by an exchange process. So we're very much concerned with the issue of detention, and certainly guests like Alexander and probably Jonathan would want constantly to put the case that detention is part of an assault on the rights of migrants and refugees generally, and will defend strongly the case you're making.
And maybe just to respond very briefly to that last point, Red Cross is really concerned about the mental health pressures on our service users, but also our staff as well, who are supporting destitute clients. We've invested recently in our psychosocial support to frontline staff and service users, but I think we can always do more. And these kind of alliances and networks, I think, can make the Red Cross even more effective. So thank you. Maybe we can talk more.
Yep, so let's take a few more questions there. I'll name me first. I think that I said that I would go to him first, and then to Jill.
Right. Just to announce the pledge, action is better than louder than word. You're talking about changing perception, and I would like people here making a pledge to commit themselves just to try one thing to change the perception we talked about the last couple of days. Is maybe in 3 months' time, or in 6 months' time, every single delegate from here, the boss full of asylum seekers, refugees, well-established members of the community, and meet in front of the Daily Mails with flowers, cake, and all these things, and to tell them, you don't hate us, you just don't understand us, and invite them to talk to us, and you will see the difference. If people can pledge to commit themselves to that, it doesn't cost any money anymore. It's just a boss from Bristol, a boss from Oxford, a boss from Birmingham, a boss from Manchester, with asylum seekers, refugees, and migrants, and we meet there. We have to get our agenda out. If you agree, we fix the day, and we commit to do that.
So we're going to Jill next in the third row. I'll just have to make a note of your questions, so we're going to come here next.
There is an organisation or an institution called the College of Emotion and Law, which is run by a woman called Jenny Hurley, who have done a lot of work about people who've come here, the migrants, who've suffered really traumatic situations and are suffering from PTSD, and they have done a lot of work in certainly I've been to training they've done so that people involved in the system are aware of the effects that has.
You can come to the front, and then I have three more people who are asking questions, but come to the front please, Wyatt. Thank you.
I am Nafees Ahmed from India. I'm teaching in the Faculty of Legal Studies of South Asian University. I'm not asking any question. First of all, I pay my sincere gratitude and thanks to the organizers. I got this opportunity. I don't know in future when I would be here. With all of us, there is a commonality of thoughts and connectivity in our perception. All of us are talking of action, action, action. But at the same time, we should not underestimate academic writings as well. And sir, it has been a great opportunity, and I have immensely been successful in changing the perception in the Sarpi University about 1951 convention relating to the status of refugees, and your writings have been immensely helpful. And from South Asia, only one country is a party to 1951 convention, and that is Afghanistan, and the rest of the South Asian 7 countries are not a party to this particular immensely important convention, and that should be treated as a magna carta so far refugees are concerned. So for academic writings, I am immensely thankful to you, and you are the part of my course curriculum in South Asian University. Thank you, sir. Thank you once again.
So I think we have three questions or comments for the speakers to respond to now in various ways. I hope you remember them, and then I have at least three more to come back to the floor for afterwards. Again, I have no particular order for the speakers.
Shall I?
Yeah,
go first. I'd like to respond particularly to Almami's suggestion. I'm not sure about the flowers at the Daily Mail. I think it's a possibility, but I think what is really interesting is the idea we plan an action
On the question of public opinion, so this is reaching out beyond the dealing with the immediate needs and abuses suffered by refugees and asylum seekers themselves, and it's tackling the various institutions that help to create the negative opinion. Maybe the Daily Mail, maybe other institutions as well, maybe broadcasters, maybe. And it might be interesting to do it not only in London, and buses to London is an idea, but I guess one wouldn't get tens of thousands of people. But what might be interesting is to think of something across the country where on a certain day, and it might be in response to something that happens, we don't have to wait long for some really dreadful media moment when the rights of refugees and other migrants are being abused. So it might be in response or it might be something planned. It's an idea, I think, that we use the activism, and a lot of people, I imagine, in the kind of climate we've all recognised, a lot of people beyond the usual activists might be interested in this. I mean, perhaps they should be at Yarlswood as well, but as our colleague earlier reminded us, but certainly I think tackling biased treatment in the media, the lies of the media, the inhuman misrepresentation of what people are, who people are, and why they've moved, I think this might have quite a lot of interest, and it might be a useful exercise in mobilising our strength.
Thank you. Do you want to respond?
We need to start from somewhere. I like actions, right? Because it speaks louder than words. Daily Mail is one of the targets because it's well known by its infamous bias reporting. So we need to start from Daily Mail with a gesture of love, with a gesture of care, saying we don't hate you, and we don't believe you hate us. You just don't understand us. We are here with cake, with flowers, to welcome you to talk to us. We go to Daily Express next time. We go to MP's house next time with flowers. We identify people who can use the support of communication. Once they write something, hundreds of thousands will read it the next day. It's better than going to Yarl's Woods is one step, but Yarl's Woods is not writing any articles. We make the news when going to the answer. We will make the news when going to Daily Mail because we will invite Daily Telegraph, we will invite all the newspapers, we will be around to photograph and film and interview people asking them why you're bringing flowers to Daily Mail, not to us.
Thank you. So, do you want to make any responses? Yes?
Can I just come in on... The Daily Mail is a great example, and I really love your approach in the whole discussion, where all the way through your approach has been to address hatred with compassion, to not respond by lowering the level of the debate, but actually just embracing people that are on opposite sides of the debate. I think that's a wonderful starting point. And I think thinking about the Daily Mail is a huge challenge to all of us. The Daily Mail is not, in my mind, a newspaper. It's a political instrument of propaganda with a very strong political economy and set of economic motives behind that. But how we address and in some ways expose those institutions and those dominant narratives, I think, is a big challenge for all of us. I agree that action is absolutely crucial to everything we have to do, and we have to be very strategic about that. But I also think there's a balance between strategically coming up with new initiatives that we collectively engage the public in, and we can only probably do that a few times, so we've got to do it very well at scale, and also ensuring that we recognise the amazing things that are already going on the ground and tell stories about those things. I mean, I continue to be struck by Caroline Gregory's comment that she's seen so many things initiated by so many people, and the challenge is we don't hear enough about the brilliant things that are already going on. So this isn't just about saying, what are the new things we do? It's about shining a light on the really positive stories that exist, getting those out to the public, so that the many people in the British public and elsewhere who I think desperately want to do something and saying, how can we help, can attach themselves to something. And I'll just give you one example because I think it shows the simplicity of this. A couple of weeks ago I was in Sheffield And I met a few people within Sheffield who had organised something called the Conversation Club. And the idea is exactly what it sounds. It's a space. They use whichever spaces they can get in the community, church halls, for instance, and they invite refugees and migrants who have been in Sheffield for a long time, students, businesses, people from the local community, to talk. And the outcome is a number of things. It's the acquisition of English language. It's social contact. It's network building. It, in some cases, translates into business opportunities and employment and initiative. Things like that, on a grassroots level, need to be amplified and recognised and given the chance to bloom and inspire others to replicate. So it's about the new actions, but it's about recognising the really good things we've got and allowing those to inspire broader audience, I think.
We've got one more round of questions, I think, and there are three people already I know wanted to ask a question. The lady at the back, the gentleman near the partition in the middle, and the lady in front of him.
Thank you for the opportunity. Admittedly, I would like to say that there aren't many rivers to cross. This problem is like mental health recovery. It takes a very, very long time. And desperation to deal with a situation can actually cause chaos. And it's just a comment or a word of caution, although most of it was mentioned by Alex. In any crisis, negotiation, dialogue, advocacy are key. And these must be done with the right people who actually have the power to create change, or who can make referrals for change. Because just going anywhere and talking about issues to people who don't have the power or who don't have the accountability or responsibility about what you are talking about will not achieve much for individuals or for wider community of asylum seekers. I would actually like to commend this group here, and I would like to say that building is easier than rebuilding. Rebuilding is tougher because much has been destroyed, and you have to pick up pieces together. You've got to remove the rubble and all these things. So if we can actually find ways and means of forming networks and try to agree, you know, on the way forward, and then make strategies to engage in diplomacy or dialogue and negotiation with key people, with the right people. It's a war of hearts and minds, and what we'll be seeking is a paradigm shift for people to change their minds about the way they've been doing things. Otherwise, it will all end up in words, you know, as things have gone on. You know, having worked perhaps in Africa, sometimes you find files. You know, United Nations offices. I did an internship for 3 months, and files are collecting dust because people are just discussing academic stuff with the little intention to change things. By the time they want to do something, something else has taken place. So please, I am willing actually to work with all of you, or whoever is willing to go forward in terms of dialogue, negotiation, and diplomacy. And together, I think in unity, we'll be able to achieve much than pulling, you know, away from each other. And then another person thinking their ideas are more important than others. But if we can actually network and make decisions, even if it's one decision, you know, that will actually move clients who are asylum seekers from where they are to somewhere different. That's because as research goes, you are not meant to solve the whole world's problems. Sometimes one generation is just meant to move a situation from a particular place just a step higher, and another generation will take it to another level. So thank you very, very much, and I'd like to say I'm very interested, and I'd like to work with all of you, if possible. Thank you.
Yes, the gentleman near the partition door, and then the lady in front of him.
Straight question, what are the difficulties, if any, in connecting the causation of refugees and migrants with needs for sanctuary and solidarity?
Thank you. And we'll take the last question as well.
What do you think is the greatest challenge to, you were talking about agencies, Mr. Santon, of the challenges of mobilising the host community?
Thank you. Over to the panel. I don't mind who goes first, whoever wants to.
I'd respond on perhaps particularly two of those things. I'm not sure if I took the comment from our colleague halfway back the right way, but if I could interpret it as talking about dialogue and negotiation with, and then it will link with this question just now, with the host community, the people who are so far not convinced. Because, like Alexander, I feel this is something we have to get much better at. Mobilising the host community is something I did refer to a little bit. As I mentioned, what I've heard, partly in the bit of research we did and through everything I've heard this weekend as well and elsewhere, is that people are starting to be mobilised already, or have been over the last 6 to 9 months, whom we would not have expected to take up the cause of asylum, the rights of refugees and migrants. Something is happening already. I think very much, as others have said, that we, and Alexander particularly just emphasised this, we need to bring that out and amplify it. I think that's exactly the right word. I think the more we do that, the more it's going to encourage people where, for example, there is not yet a group collecting to support migrants, for example, in camps on the continent, where there is not a group befriending migrants or taking... But where it's not happening, once people see the examples, I think we'll find more willing to do that. I've emphasised... And this maybe takes us a little bit further into new terrain. I've emphasised the question, highlighted the question, can we also think about people who are concerned with rights and discrimination in various forms? I mentioned LGBT, disability, people involved in homelessness, people in trade unions, in all our areas, all our regions and cities, who not really sure about asylum, or kind of listening to both sides, listening to the Daily Mail even, some of them may be, who, if we got into a conversation with them, and the right kind of conversation, the right way, and I absolutely agree about not going in with hostility, but with cake and flowers, and certainly with understanding, with a willingness to listen, I think there's a lot of people there who would very readily come to support our cause, not just, and this is really crucial, not just because they can see that asylum seekers have the needs and that the right to sanctuary is a fundamental right, but because they understand in some very big long-term way this is part of their own cause as well, that human rights do matter to them. Now, it's no accident that people who've been so vicious in government about asylum about retrenching on the rights, about really walking away from the 1951 convention, those are also people who want to scrap the Human Rights Act. It's a wholesale attack on people's rights, driving towards a world where instead people have power only according to how much money they've got on their credit card and how much money they've got in the bank. It's a fundamental opposition between two views of the world. And we have lots of allies. I would say now a majority who are willing to listen to us. But you're right, and our mummy's right. We have to find the right ways of talking to them.
Thank you.
Can I just respond to your question, Prudence? I think what you highlight is about the need for us not just to have more than just goodwill, we've also got to have a strategy. And it's about ensuring that we attach not only having a heart, but also having a head about the strategies we adopt. And that we recognise where there are nodes in our network, where people have particular forms of access to power and influence, and how we use those particular nodes of influence to have impact. I mean, it would be probably quite straightforward for a number of us to sit down and work out who the top 20 most influential people are on British asylum and immigration policy. And we might not particularly appreciate some of the people who would be on that list, but we could pull that together. And then we could ask ourselves, which of those people have the power to do particular things, and which of those do we need to push in particular ways to shift the needle if we're thinking about political change? And then we could ask ourselves, who amongst us has people in our networks who have access to those particular people? And so I think my view is that if you're going to build a movement, part of that is at the very grassroots level. Part of it's about mobilising the public, changing public opinion. But part of it's also about a political strategy that has to be very savvy, very thought through, very strategic, based on clear messages, and getting those messages into the hands of key people. And I think this movement is relatively new. I mean, it's the one silver lining to the so-called refugee crisis in Europe, the movement and mobilisation of the public. But for that to become strategic and have impact, it needs real thought about how we're going to channel that and make the best use of it. Just a very brief thought on your question, Ed, if I understood it rightly, of how you connect the needs of people with public solidarity. How do you bring them together? I think, what could you just repeat?
Sorry, trying to establish it, the question now. What are the difficulties, if any, of connecting the causation of refugees and migrants with needs for sanctuary and solidarity?
What do you mean by causation? The reasons why they come?
Right, so there's natural disasters, wars,
okay,
famine, inequality, etc. And it has been touched on a bit, but
yeah.
I don't think it
could... Yeah. I suppose one of the debates we've had throughout today in places is the narrative about the changing reasons why people come to the UK. And the questions that are being asked about the 1951 Convention and its ongoing relevance, and the lurch we've had towards saying, if you're a refugee, you are worthy. If you're a migrant, you're here for voluntary economic reasons and you're unworthy. And I think that the challenge for all of us is not to fall into that trap of asserting that one set of people are deserving, another set of are not, because of the reasons that they've left their country of origin. Yes, the reasons why people have left their country of origin might give rise to particular needs, but they shouldn't be used to undermine the rights that all people have as human beings to human rights, and the vulnerabilities that different migrant categories have, irrespective of whether they're not or not they're refugees. So I think it's incumbent on all of us to think through how we articulate the relationship between refugees and other categories of migrant, and not fall into the trap of saying, if you're a refugee, you're deserving. If you're a migrant of some other legal or institutional category, you're not. There may be different needs, but that doesn't obviate the fact that as human beings, they have rights and entitlements.
So, Jonathan, do you want, have you got any final words?
Just two very quick reflections on the questions. I do think a narrative which explains why people are coming, why people are forced to flee, is hugely important. And I welcome the emergence into debate of international NGOs like Save the Children and Oxfam. And it helps to give that wider narrative, why people are fleeing, why people are on the move. That has to be good. And I have to say, I would like to see the Red Cross talking more about why people are on the move. Not just the end results, but that initial motivation. I think it's really important to get that understanding. And then the final reflection in terms of the host community. If we can do anything in terms of building this movement, you know, a movement's about political action, it's also about connecting human beings. We've got to get people connected, meet asylum seekers, meet refugees, recognise our common humanity, and thereby an accident of birth go us. You know, I think we really have to show that common humanity, and that's the stage that we can really build a movement of common, united, focused humans.
Thank you. Thanks to our panel. Please join me in thanking them. I think Wayne's got a few words left.
I've just got some thank yous to make. Thank you, all of you, for coming. It's so much appreciated. Thanks to all the contributors, all the people giving talks, and all the people who have such intelligent questions from the audience. Thanks to the Refugee Studies Centre for even considering having a conference here and working with Oxford City of Sanctuary. But I have two really big thank yous to make. And the first and definitely the most important thank you is to all the refugees, asylum seekers and migrants who today and yesterday have so courageously shared their stories and brought emotion back into the room. And if I've learned anything, it's that is so important, that we keep coming back to our feelings so that we can connect. So thank you so much for that. The idea for this conference, and I don't take much credit for this, came out of an informal discussion between me and Alex after the Refugee Week event last year. And we both got a bit involved in the organisation early on. And then both in our different ways kind of withdrew from the organisation set up. And I'm a bit ashamed about that. Thankfully, a superb group of individuals took over the organisation and did a fantastic job making this conference happen. And I watched the emails as they whizzed by between this group. I didn't have time to even read all the emails, you know, meeting after meeting after meeting. It's unbelievable how much organisation goes into a conference like this. So if I could just invite the organisers to stand up, can we just give them a round of applause? There's a couple of very important ones missing from this room. They're probably organising something elsewhere. Anyway, big thanks to all of them and all of you. When you go, please make sure you've got all your belongings. Please bring your cups out and that sort of thing. Make sure you're signed up on all the lists.